This audio download on the Iranian Revolution was recorded in the Teachers Club. It's of a hands-off the people of Iran public meeting, and the speaker is Torab Salah, who took part in the movement of 1979 and speaks of his personal experiences on the Iranian left. You can read some of his articles at www.hopi-ireland.org. You'll find other audio downloads at www.wsm.ie.
Greetings, everybody. To go straight to the point, the Iranian Revolution was basically a direct reaction to a capitalist crisis in Iran, which developed in 74-75. The first signs of it began to appear in 74-75, and it was sort of fully, you know, like what you have now. It took another year or so before it became quite, you know, obvious what we are going through. This was probably the first capitalist crisis, proper capitalist crisis in Iranian society. Because the 15 years prior to that, Iran had undergone a huge program of expansion of capitalist economy around what the Shah called his White Revolution, which was sort of initiated in early 1960. By 63, it took 2-3 years for the full program to be implemented, but by 63 it was, you know, fully in operation. This was a program which the Shah called the program modernization. It was basically a program of industrialization, led and managed and directed mostly by U.S. banks and U.S. foundations at the time. This was not peculiar to Iran. Similar plans were being implemented in Latin America to different, you know, degrees, and also in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Philippines. They all went through similar program. The program actually comes out of Marshall Plan. It's an appendix to Marshall Plan for the Third World, as it were. The program was very simple. It was based on exporting means of production to Iran under license from foreign companies and then producing the consumer goods inside Iran itself. Basically, it was replacing import of consumer goods with internal production, mostly with joint ventures, with foreign capital, and as I said, under almost daily management of, you know, foreign capital itself, represented in Iran by USA at the time. The program, in its first few years, had really important, you know, significant results. For almost 11, 12 years, Iran went through a rate of growth of almost 8-9% annually in GDP. The composition of Iranian population from mostly rural changed to mostly urban. The size of the Iranian working class in the 15 years increased from about 1.5 million to 4.5 million. So you can see there was a huge program financed by the oil money, of course. But by 1974, this program had run out of steam. And the reasons behind it is obvious. When you import second-hand technology to produce consumer goods, you cannot obviously sell those consumer goods abroad because they're already a lot more expensive than, you know, in Europe. In 74, for example, same monetary fund set up a committee to investigate problems of the Iranian economy, and they came up with this figure that the cost of production in Iran, despite cheap labor, cheap energy resources, all the advantages of producing in such a backward economy, the cost of production is still 30% higher than similar goods in Europe. So you could not obviously sell these goods abroad. They were too expensive. And given the nature of the state, the corruption, etc., etc., you can add even more to the cost of production. So basically, this expansion reached the boundaries of the national market soon, and the growth stopped. As part of this program, for example, they carried out what was called a land reform. Land reform, basically, you could say, released something like 40% of the peasant population from any ties to the land. By distributing the land, giving some a piece of land, you actually broke the ties of the others in the village community from the same land because of some sort of sharecropping communal arrangements in Iranian traditional agriculture, which was broken up by the land reform. This 40% population of the rural areas released from any ties to the land was supposed to provide the new labor force for the new industries. At first, as all this was growing, everything was hunky-dory, as it were. As soon as these people were released from land, they could be absorbed into this new growing industry. But as this expansion reached limits, you began to notice the effects of this program. There were huge explosions in shanty towns in almost every major city in Iran, especially Tehran, the capital. In 74-75, you have something like 500,000 people living in shanty towns in Tehran. These are basically rural migrants who cannot find jobs. In fact, the Iranian authorities used to call them out-of-bounds people. They were referred to as out-of-bounds, meaning they are out-of-city bounds, so the city has no responsibility. The city authorities have no responsibility to provide them with water, electricity, or the usual urban services. Then there was obviously a huge expansion in prices, a huge inflation developed. In order not to make more profit, they had to sort of push up prices. You had reached a situation in which, I think similar in Britain in 1978-79, you had the first type of capitalist crisis, famous as a stagflation. You have a stagnation plus inflation. This is precisely what we faced in 76 in Iran. The first signs of the revolutionary movement actually began in the shanty towns. There were clashes, almost daily clashes, in the summer of 76 in south of Tehran between these urban dwellers, shanty town dwellers, and the military sort of security forces of the Iranian regime. It ended up by the Shah being forced to actually bring in the army to crush the movement. Few months later, the first waves of workers' strike began to develop in Iran. And most of the initial workers' strike, this is we're talking about 76, early 77. Most of the strikes were actually economical demands, and they all succeeded, more or less all of them. Their demands were met. Then, few months later, in 77, a student movement began organizing pickets, demonstrations, almost daily. That was sort of quashed, and it went all quiet. Later on that year, Iranian poets and writers organized poetry reading nights, which became really mass rallies. Goethe Institute, the German embassy had a Goethe Institute in Tehran, and every night there were tens of thousands of Iranians gathering to listen to poetry readings, but turning all these meetings into political rallies. Then a second wave of workers' strike began. This second wave was interesting in the sense that it had become a lot more political. Among the various economic demands, there were now appearing political demands, like freedom of political prisoners, or things which were directly, against the actual government rather than anything to do with the economic condition. So you could see, from any sort of criteria that you may use, you could see the Iranian revolution is beginning to. We are entering a period of revolutionary crisis. Because one of the signs of this ever-increasing sort of pressure on the Iranian government was very interesting. For example, workers would go on a strike and win their demands. Then 2 months later, go back on a strike and demand even more, because they were gaining confidence. The masses were obviously gaining confidence, and they realized the regime is on the run, so let's push for more. So you had wave after waves of these strikes. So what I want to bring to your attention is, let's for a minute forget the Islamic thing. The actual mass movement which created the revolutionary crisis was a genuine anti-capitalist mass movement. But it had no leadership. During the Shah, even bourgeois opposition was not allowed to operate. There was a single party during the last few years of its rule. And obviously the left was already decimated. The Tudor party, which was the main, the sort of pro-Soviet Iranian version of a pro-Soviet CP, which called itself the Tudor party, the mass party. It was formed during the Second World War on the basis of the Popular Front, so they didn't even call themselves a communist party. They called them, it was actually a popular front in one party. Later on they claimed, no, we were always a workers' party, but in the beginning they didn't even claim it's a workers' party. That's why they called themselves the mass party. This party had become totally discredited in the 1953 coup, because they had a huge influence inside the Iranian army. Before the 53 coup, the Tudor party was the biggest party in Iran. Even the bourgeois parties were not as large as, the Tudor party. Tudor party more or less had won over the entire Iranian working class, the first organization, mass organization of the Iranian working class, the Trade Union Confederation that existed, had actually managed to organize something like 500,000 workers at the time. The oil strikes during the national, oil industry strikes during the nationalization movement was actually led by the Tudor party. Most of the Iranian intellectuals were members of the Tudor party. So it was a very dominant force within the Iranian opposition to the monarchy. But it had completely lost its credibility after the coup in 53, because they didn't lift a finger to resist the coup, basically. They didn't back Mossadegh. Basically, because of, because of deals which go back to the Second World War between the Allies, this was the area of influence of USA and Soviet Union. At the crucial moment, sort of pulled back and didn't resist the coup. So the coup was successful, and the Shah was sort of put back on power. And after that, as a reaction to this, the youth section of this party actually became very critical. And this is what led eventually to the formation of the first sort of armed struggle group, guerrilla group in Iran, called the Fedais, the devotees of the people, that's the name. But they were already decimated in terms of the urban guerrilla warfare they had organized during the previous 10 years. So when the revolutionary period came, they weren't hardly present. On the night of insurrection in Tehran, there were not probably even 10 members of this group. Just to give you an indication of the level of crisis within the leadership of this movement. So there's no bourgeois opposition, there's no left opposition of any significance, there's hardly any leadership within this mass movement. And it's growing and growing and growing and gaining confidence and developing. Suddenly in 78, a new force entered the scene. And this is the religious opposition. Religious opposition existed in Iran. It's nothing new. It had existed since the constitutional revolution of 1905. In 1905, a whole section of the religious Shia hierarchy actually opposed the constitutional revolution. The leader, which was hung in front of the parliament after the victory of the revolution, said democracy is a conspiracy by West against Islam. This was Khomeini is a student of that guy. Just to know who Khomeini was, this Ayatollah who was hung in front of the Iranian parliament in 1907, I think, was actually the teacher of Khomeini. Khomeini followed Islam. Anyway, so it has a long history. Reza Shah totally suppressed the father of the last Shah, the religious opposition. But during the Second World War, when the Allies occupied Iran and sent Reza Shah to exile him to South Africa and put his son on the throne, there was a whole period in which the movement could, you know, because of the weakness of the central government, there was quite a lot of political activity. And this is when, in fact, the Tudor Party formed, 1941. In the same time, these religious groups became active too. Khomeini, for example, wrote a famous pamphlet in those days about the need for Islamic government. The pamphlet, the idea of an Islamic government, actually comes from a pamphlet he wrote in that period. But the religious opposition more or less collaborated with the CIA coup of 1953. They were very worried about secularization of Iranian society under Mossadegh, the sort of bourgeois nationalist currents which were in government at the time and were overthrown by CIA coup. So they backed, they more or less, without the Shia, a lot of people who write about the CIA coup of 1953 forget one very important fact. This coup was actually carried out twice. The first one failed. Then within a few days later, they organized the second one, which won. The reason the second one won was because the Shia hierarchy swung behind the second one. They were persuaded to support because of fear of communism. Because if you don't, that was the idea then, it is still the idea today. If you don't, you know, then the left is going to take over, and you know, you don't know what's going to happen. That type of ideology was even used in those periods. Anyway, the Shia hierarchy swung behind the coup, and more or less not openly but actively behind the scenes supported the coup. A lot of the mobs in Tehran were actually organized by Shia hierarchy during the coup. Instead of paying back, you know, this Shia hierarchy for all its help, in fact, this program of so-called white revolution, this program of industrialization, ran counter to their interests. Because of the nature of Iranian society, that every revolutionary movement, every mass uprising for democratic change, for secularization, has been defeated by the West, by intervention by the West. First the Russians, then the British, and then the American. You know, if you go from 1905 till now, these three have suppressed and destroyed every movement for progress or for change or for democratic change or for transformation of Iranian society. So what we have now, we have accumulated all these reactionary classes that should have been swept away by the revolutions, the previous revolutions. They're all there. You know, you still have the merchants of the bazaar, you still have the Shia hierarchy, you still have all these, you know, absentee landlords who more or less own the whole country, you have the nobility, you have all these layers within the Iranian ruling class, which each belong to different, you know, periods of Iranian history, simply because all these changes have taken place from above. Nobody has ever overthrown any of these people. They're still there. Even today, they're all still there. So what happened? two groups within this traditional ruling class, Iranian ruling class. One is the Shia hierarchy. And don't forget, Iran was an Asiatic mode of production in which the state more or less owned everything. There was no private ownership of land. Even the merchants were actually state employees. The state organized the merchant class. After the breakup of the Asiatic mode of production, Shia hierarchy took over the endowment land, which was devoted for their upkeep. And the merchants actually took the monopoly of foreign trade as now their own private, means of enrichment. So these two classes were powerful groups within the traditional Iranian ruling class, which had remained there all this time. Now, this program of substituting consumer goods by internal production ran counter to the interests of the merchants. And the merchants were basically dominant within the Iranian economy. They were the most dominant group within the Iranian economy. The White Revolution was directly opposite to their interests. Because, in fact, it could obviously be seen, because the first thing the Shah did, introduced import tariffs. So they could no longer import all these consumer goods to protect the new industries. They introduced these import tariffs to stop the merchants being able to bring in the same goods and selling them cheaper than what they produce internally. Also the land reform. The Shia hierarchy was by now one of the biggest landlords in Iran. Given the weakness of the central state, as I said, had taken over all these lands, and these are religious land. This land was devoted by such and such a guy to us. When he died, he wrote this will and he gave up. They took over almost. They were the biggest landlord in Iran, so they were obviously very much opposed to the land reform. So these two groups in 1960 to 63, when this White Revolution was being implemented, organized quite a number of protests, demonstrations, rallies, speeches, and Khomeini became a leader of that movement. Khomeini was a very fiery, sort of Islamic speaker who, called the Shah agent, basically a Jew. That was the biggest insult, you could give, that he's a Jew, he's an infidel Jew. This is the exact phrase by Khomeini, that this White Revolution is, against Islam. And they organized a revolt in 63, which was crushed, completely crushed, and Khomeini was sent into exile to Iraq. Suddenly, this was a big opportune moment in history for them to get their own back on the show. So they entered the scene, basically in 78. There is a revolution, there is a mass movement, the regime is weak, this is our time to move in. And they started, moving in, basically. But they were hardly significant. They were there, but they were hardly a significant force. Even at the height of their strength in 1963, the Shah's regime easily crushed the whole thing and reorganized the whole Shia hierarchy in their own interest and sent the rest of the troublemakers to exile. They were, during all these 15 years that had passed, every couple of years you would see a tape of one sermon Khomeini has given, in Najaf when he was, to his theological students. Hardly the type of regular political statements on this anniversary. Even on the anniversaries, you wouldn't see this regular political statement. So, those of us who were active inside the Iranian opposition, we didn't take them seriously. Because they were not much of a force as such. They had no credential over the last 15 years of doing anything. So to us it was very surprising. How come suddenly These groups are so much vocal and so much more organized, loads of money and financing things. In fact, they started even, you might find this a joke, they were actually financing the strikes. The last oil strike was actually financed by them. They were carrying suitcases full of money to the oil workers to encourage them to carry on, you know, to keep longer, keep the strike going. So they started intervening in the mass movement. And within 6 months, they basically took over the mass movement. Partly because of confusion of the masses, they didn't know any, they didn't have any alternative leadership, they didn't have any reason to doubt these mullahs. They were against the Shah, they were against USA, they were against capitalism, they were saying capitalism is bad, you know, all the things that, you know, the signs that, you know, the masses were supposed to pick on, you know, were there to consider these people are good. They were promising heaven on earth, you know. Oil money was going to be distributed among the population, you know. Shanty towns were going to be a thing of the past. Everybody would, you know, Iran would enjoy full employment. Oil and gas and, you know, electricity would be free for everybody. You know, they were promising heaven on the earth. So partly it was our fault. The masses themselves fell for this. But that wasn't all. Even then it was obvious, but now it is actually well documented and well, you know, written about. A lot of active players in those days have now written their memoirs, and, you know, you can actually put all the things together and, you know, draw a much clearer picture. What emerges is basically U.S. imperialism and British imperialism, the two main parties very interested in Iranian politics, realize there is a revolution. The Shah is going to go and there's no way they can save him. So they have to find an alternative. They try various other bourgeois sort of politicians from the old National Front. None of those cut any ice with the masses because they were even more discredited than the Tudor party. So basically, they started negotiating with the Islamic opposition. In fact, they were negotiating. Both, they had teams negotiating in USA, teams negotiating in Paris, teams negotiating in Tehran with US administration and sections of the Iranian ruling class itself, including the SAVAK and the army. So huge program began to develop, led by sections of the Iranian state itself. And in SAVAK, they had a huge Islamic section, actually, because the Islamic were the most zealot anti-communists. So what better agents can you recruit than these, you know, anti-communist zealots, you know, from the religious, you know, gangs under the rule of these ayatollahs. In fact, there was a whole section of the Iranian SAVAK, which was run by an ayatollah called Ayatollah Halabi, who is very interesting to note. This guy is the teacher of Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad, actually, you know, in Shia Islam, every individual has to follow, emulate one ayatollah. This was his guru, as it were. So just to know who is Ahmadinejad, you know, in terms of his historical background. This whole section within the Iranian SAVAK itself started actually organizing support for Khomeini. For example, suddenly an article appears, you know, this is the before Khomeini became famous. Article appeared in the Persian press. Don't forget, we are talking about a regime in which you cannot breathe even without SAVAK, you know, signing off. This article appears in, you know, the official press attacking Khomeini as a Soviet agent. I mean, the biggest insult you can give to Khomeini, because these, you cannot get more anti-communist than these guys, you know. To call him a Soviet agent, black reaction, which is uniting this red reaction, and this is what they are planning, and behind it is British imperialism. This was the article, official Iranian press. Then suddenly demonstrations against this article began to appear. Then the regime, obviously, the Shah killed, 200 of them. Then every 40 days, they organize this demonstration in Islamic tradition of the dead. After 40 days, you have a sort of ceremony. And four or five of these, waves, they dominated the mass movement. Summer of 78, the students were reporting in Tehran. I mean, the student movement had this slogan, which was very famous in those days: unity, struggle, victory. In every demonstration, they would carry this sort of a student movement, carry this banner. Students who tried to carry this banner inside the mass movement were beaten up by the Islamic, stewards of the demonstrations, that you are communists. So they even started attacking, the left 6 months before the revolution. These were already happening. So it emerges, basically, a section of the bourgeoisie realize they have no alternative. As in Iraq now, they have no alternative. You have to make a deal. So they made a deal with Khomeini. In fact, they helped him and pushed him to the front, and made a deal for a change of government. And they sent a General Hoheizer at the time, NATO command, to go and sort of gain the approval of the Iranian army. Because the Iranian army is still faithful to the Shah, and without that you cannot have this change. And the Iranian army basically agreed. Don't forget, these are people created by CIA anyway, so obviously they would agree. So they agreed for a change of government from above. And as it is happening now in Iraq, the deal was not for a theocratic regime. The deal was for a democratic Islamic regime, as we now have in Iraq, a democratic Islamic regime, on the Bazargan. And Bazargan was agreed to become the prime minister. In fact, an insurrection should not have taken place. They dispatched the Shah to Egypt. The army became neutral, didn't intervene in the mass movement, and they appointed Bakhtiar government, which promised return to the Iranian constitution. The Royal Guards in Tehran, which a strong force in Tehran, really cracked sort of units of the Iranian army, as you can imagine. This is the Royal Guard. They didn't like this deal. So they organized a march to the Air Force base in Tehran, which they called the center of the conspiracy against the Shah, the Air Force base. And from north of Tehran, which is their barracks, by the time they get to south of Tehran, where this Air Force base was, obviously people of Tehran got to know about this and resisted this march of the Royal Guards. The technicians in the Air Force base distributed the opened arsenals to the people, and basically people of Tehran became armed. Almost 300, it's estimated, almost 300,000, guns, machine guns, various, armaments were distributed that night among the Iranian population in Tehran. This began about 9 o'clock. By 4 o'clock in the morning, people had ransacked every Sabah station, every police station, every military bar, everything. Everything. The regime fell. By 4 o'clock in the morning, the regime fell. Even by 4 o'clock in the morning, Khomeini supporters were still standing on the street saying, Imam has not ordered an uprising. Go back home. They didn't want this because they had already made the deal. So the insurrection happened despite Khomeini's leadership. The next day we woke up, suddenly this new government came, Bazargan, and 14 military committees in Tehran. And these were not phony, they were really committees with headquarters, with an army behind them, declared they ruled Tehran. Now it appears, it emerged only in the last day. But no, these committees were set up a year earlier. They were being organized from a year earlier. So basically what I'm trying to say is the Iranian revolution was a genuine revolution. A whole section, a reactionary section of the traditional Iranian ruling class saw its chance, its historical chance, to gain back the position of power it had lost to the new capitalist, industrial capitalist faction. Imperialism realized it has no choice other than this. The only way they can save the bourgeois state is by supporting this alternative. So they put their backing behind it. They became the leadership of the movement and took over power. So this is basically the story of the Iranian revolution. So anyway, so we had a sort of liberal, democratic, nationalist coalition in power after the insurrection. But soon, the counter-revolution began. It was obvious. And of course, what do you do to defeat a revolution? You roll back. Before anything else, all the democratic gains. So freedom of press, freedom of assembly, freedom of political parties, all these, one by one, started being crushed. Then they said, okay, what's the weakest link in Iranian society? Women and national minorities. If you attack women, probably most of the men agree. Iranian men, anyway. So the first attacks were organized on women. If you attack national minorities, all the Iranian nationalists would agree. So let's attack the national minorities. So campaign of consolidating the counter-revolution began soon after the insurrection. But this whole period took almost two and a half years. It wasn't done all in the first week. It took 2-3 years for the counter-revolution to establish itself and defeat the revolution. Even 2 years down the line, we could have still fought this. The only problem was the left was basically didn't have the political strategy at the time. They were a bit confused. Don't forget, this is a very populist left. This was at the time, very populist left. Anti-imperialism, anti-Shah, you know, not class-based left. And it didn't realize most of these attacks. For example, you would get, you know, Fedai members say, oh, okay, wear your hijab, you know, this is not important. We are in the middle of a revolution, you know, this is not the most important issue. You know, wearing an Islamic hijab, you know, okay, let's wear it and go, you know. This is not what is serious, is, you know, what's happening out there. You know. Or, yeah, national minority, yeah, we don't agree, but, you know, why should Arabs have all the oil, you know? Because the south, for example, where the oil fields are, is mostly dominated by Arab population in Iran. So the left itself was very confused. I can go on, you know, for hours. So if it's best, if you can ask me more concrete questions, points that interest you, or, you know, you want to know more about, then I can be a bit more concrete and shorter rather than waffle along.
Well, when you were on tour at Miss Antonia, there was Antonia? was asking about, you know, the various terms, and, you know,
what terms?
The terms, you know, the Shah, the Khomeini, that's, you know, what the organizations, the Secret Service in yeah. Iran, oh. all of these people. And what I was saying, and I was really simplifying things, oh. was that essentially the Shah had been in power. There'd been attempts to change, there'd been attempts at revolution in Iran since the beginning of the 20th century. And the Shah had been in power, was deeply unpopular, was promoted and sponsored by the United States, had gone, you know, undertaken this program of industrialization, which had resulted in, when it collapsed, in mass unemployment, and, you know, there was tremendous corruption, and yes, it kind of sounds like it's like Ireland today, doesn't it? And that the revolution came out of that. Well, as you said, that the revolution was hijacked. And that we actually have articles at the back here by Torah, which I photocopied for people to take away and to read. And obviously there are links, there are articles on the website, Hands Off People Iran website, but that it was hijacked. And when I was talking to Torah earlier today, he actually has done an interview, an hour and a half interview already today at the FM radio station, which I think partly contributes to the fact that he's been a bit hoarse and talking, was that, but one of the things that has come up, which is one of the things that's presented time and time again, is that 1979 was an Islamic revolution, and that people today that say that the people of Iran should be freed from the current regime are responded to with this is what they wanted, this was what the revolution was about, this is why they took to the streets of Tehran. And why we've termed this the hidden history is that actually this is not to say that there wasn't support for Khomeini within Iran, but there wasn't principally first from the working class, but the fact was that there was, a vacuum in leadership when the revolution happened. The left was too weak and confused and too tied to the Soviet Union's policies. And the working class itself hadn't produced its own leadership, political leadership. And in those circumstances, the Khomeini was able to step into that vacuum, but also that he stepped into that vacuum with the backing of the United States. So the idea that also is argued that, you know, that he is anti-imperialist is actually completely wrong. That in fact he was imperialism's choice against the prospect of a working class government in Iran, and that it was only subsequently that his so-called anti-imperialism became actually anything. When the Americans put him into power, and then afterwards he said, you know, piss off the Americans, I can work it on my own. So I don't know whether that's any help for you in understanding mm-hmm. dynamics of it.
Anyone is welcome to come in if you want to.
Why didn't you come back to the land instead of the... Okay, it didn't work, the of course, because all this industrial revolution just contaminating since the beginning of the century, it's ruined all the century. But why didn't you come back to the land? And now there is a slow back to the land and reorganize a little village and little communities and using the land and sell products, make your own. Like, there is now another sustainability going on around Ireland as well. Why did you come back to the land? Why did you stay in?
Yeah, I see what you mean here. It has now actually become a sort of merchants' republic, Iranian society, because the merchants are now ruling. They get the oil money, and don't forget, revenues from oil in Iran over the last 30 years have quadrupled compared to the time of the Shah, especially during the last 4 years. You can imagine how much, you know, wealth they have accumulated out of this increase in oil prices. They basically buy goods from China, from here, from there, and sell it. They love it. This is what they did. And, you know, who gives tuppence halfpenny about the population? You know, this is the Iranian. This is the most reactionary section of the old traditional Iranian ruling class, which now rules. And in 21st, and this is precisely because of the history of Iran and its, you know, links with imperialism. Imperialism is directly responsible for creating a situation in which Iranian society has become so contradictory. You have, you know, modern industry alongside, you know, mullahs and merchants of the bazaar, which belonged to 600 years ago. They were part of the Iranian ruling class 600 years ago. These people now rule. Of course, when I say these people rule, they rule within a bourgeois state. They don't rule within the Safavid Empire of 600 years ago. This is a modern bourgeois state. So they have to maintain that state. The only reason they're kept in power is because they maintain that bourgeois state. So in order to maintain that bourgeois state, you know, a number of things go with it. Which is, you know, I don't know, institutions, you have to have, you know, the army, you have to have the industry to back your army, you have to, you know, you have all sorts of, you know, state structures within a bourgeois state that they have maintained and they have in fact developed. Because at the end of the day, the state, the underlying mode of production is a lot more dominant than whatever may go in the head of you ayatollahs. You know, eventually you have to correspond with the base rather than the base corresponding with you. You know, the base is not going to change. The whole world is not going to change to correspond with your, you know, wishes. You have to adapt yourself. But being mullahs, they are very peculiar. They are very peculiar group of people. You know, they are not even like a military junta. Even Pinochet, after a few years, realizes his time has gone. Now you must hand over to the normal bourgeois politicians. But mullahs, I've always used this Persian saying. We have this Persian saying: you never get anything back from a mullah. Never lend anything to a mullah because you never get it back. In fact, this is what U.S. imperialism has learned, and this is what they're going to learn again in Iraq. You know, exactly the same scenario has happened in Iran is not happening in Iraq. Ayatollah Sistani sits in his mosque, so no, I have nothing to do with politics, you know, just general things. You know. What was very funny for me, the last municipal election in Iraq, I don't know if any of you followed a few weeks or a few months ago, all the candidates of the Islamic groups are engineers, doctors, you know, university lecturers, you know, all very civilized, you know, professional. None of the mullahs have stood for elections. Not one of them. This is precisely exactly the same game they played with U.S. imperialism in 1978. No, Khomeini, the first day he came to Iran, you know, after the deal with USA was completed, they brought Khomeini to Iran before, this is 10 days before the insurrection. On his first speech in Tehran, he said, no, I'm a religious man, I have nothing to do with politics, I'm going to go back to my theological school and carry on with my studies. Qom is the theological center of Iranian Shia Islam. Lo and behold, he not once left Tehran. Not even once to go and visit, you know, Qom. He did once, one of his friends died, he went for his funeral. But he didn't actually go to Qom, you know. He didn't ever left Tehran until he died. And even at first, this bourgeois sort of Islamic government was nothing like what Khomeini became later on. Khomeini was still in the background. He was the religious leader. He was the, you know, thinking behind the revolution rather than with his hand directly on the throne, as it were. This thing was done, it's a coup, which was carried out by the U.S. embassy occupation. U.S. embassy occupation and hostage taking led to a shift of power within the ruling clique itself. They overthrew this sort of liberal, democratic, Islamic government, and the mullahs basically took over. So even that didn't happen immediately. In the same way, you can imagine in Iraq, a few years down the line, you know, when more or less they have no fear of U.S. military presence there, I bet you they organize some kind of crisis to push for this in there too. So the mullahs directly take over. So they have gone through, you know, don't forget they are part of the Iranian ruling for 600 years. They've been there for 600 years. They are not just some people who have come from, you know, behind the mountain somewhere. You know, they are, these people are experts at, you know, maintaining a state and, you know, suppressing the population. They are experts at it. You have the, you know, Shia hierarchy in Iranian society has been part and parcel of the Iranian despotic state for centuries. So there are, all of them have PhDs in demagogy. You know, they are, you know, they are, don't let, you know, don't, you know, let them, you know, fool you by now, we are just Muslims, but, you know, these are not, these are, you know, Iranian ruling class.
Let's get some more questions in if you want. And if I could direct your attention just to one thing, what the West is focusing in now is nuclear power. To what extent is that just hype? Is it deliberately manufactured? Is there any basis whatsoever to the fears that are being manufactured? What is the strategy behind the violence of the regime against the West? But I see a couple of hands over there. Kevin?
Just one of the things which was a big weakness was that its portrayal in the West, and probably in Iran itself, was a sort of him and his hangers-on, a sort of playboy. You'd see them on what was the equivalent of hello then, you know, like they were very decadent. And that was a big weakness. And from what I remember, the Ayatollahs said that this is what democratic rights and women's rights are about, you know, Western decadence. So he made that equivalent because of the dissident lifestyle that the so-called reforming Shah led, you know, like he was just a weird wasteful, you know, like. And the other thing I'd like to see you sort of elaborate on is about the factory occupations and the, you know, the workers' councils, how they were defeated, you know, I mean, how strong they were. I'm vague about it, I'm not that much sure.
Thanks, Kevin. I'll let this man in too. You're asking a question, were you?
Oh, I have a couple of questions. I get the impression that despite all the changes and shifts in power, that it sounds like the rule is still rule and not a whole lot changed. And then my other question is on a different tack. It sounded like, just like we have today, and ever since, we started to be having it a lot over the last 30 years, but mostly over the last 80 years, bubbles, booms and busts across the world, and it sounded like that's what Iran had, but it sounded like it was stimulated by when America came in and the banks, and I was just wondering the connection between the banks and their way of doing money, which is what I believe is the big reason for lots of problems around the world today is the way that the money system is, which I don't think many people really understand. I just wanted to know the connection is there.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to respond to that? Oh, there is one.
I had a chance to visit Iran a few weeks ago, and I must say I enjoyed my time, and it was really, really great trip around the country. I visited a couple of cities. I met a couple of women rights activists, human rights activists, a couple of people who are kind of fans of the current regime as well. What's your personal opinion about the state of the regime now in terms of human rights, women rights, and the general system which is in power?
Did you say they were fans of the current regime?
Yeah.
The supporters of the current regime?
Supporters, yeah.
Okay. Carry on with the
background. All right, yes. On the nuclear issue, first of all, the nuclear program of the Iranian regime is nothing exclusive to the Mullahs. It began during the Shah. And in fact, the West was already building nuclear reactors in Iran 10 years before the Iranian Revolution. Some of the one in, for example, the one in Bushehr in the south of Iran, which is now one center of contention, one bone of contention between USA and Iran, was actually built during the Shah, 10 years before the revolution. During the Iran-Iraq war, the whole nuclear program was put on ice for obvious reasons, and then they returned it. So this is one. Secondly, economically, yes, you can say you have so much oil, why do you need a nuclear reactor? But economically, precisely because oil is so expensive, why sell it to the West? Keep it in the wells for 30 years later and use nuclear energy. So economically, it does make sense. And this was already discussed, in terms of bourgeois politics, capitalist economy, it makes perfect sense, to develop nuclear reactor and keep your oil, don't sell it. At least reduce your own internal consumption of oil and save some of this oil. So if you keep it under the ground, the price is going to go up and up and up and up. And don't forget, one of the reasons why we have this whole crisis in the Middle East is because of the fact that two-thirds of the entire global oil reserves are within the Caspian Sea Basin and the Persian Gulf Basin. So, two-thirds. And they're built. If you look at the military map of the Middle East, in fact, the term Greater Middle East is a U.S. military term, which came about simply because of building all these military bases. You see, they have encircled this whole area. The Shah has come and gone. Saddam has come and gone. Many changes have taken place. But look at the map, military bases of USA in the Middle East. They have increased from something like 11 to 39 in the last 50 years. Why? Obviously, they're protecting that whole oil field. And the papers, USA, what is good about the US system, everything is open, quite open. The papers written about it, people discuss it. If you dig out, you can find all the papers. There was actually a paper written 20 years ago on why we need to protect this region. Because if you reach peak oil, which is a period in which global consumption, the rate of growth in global consumption outpaces, the rate of growth of discoveries of new reserves. So basically it means you reach a situation in which you cannot produce enough oil for the actual consumption. Whoever has then oil resources can, basically, grab the global economy by its throat. So in terms of U.S. domination, they have had this strategy, as I said, I've written the paper written 20 years ago, and you look at the map, they have been implementing it. This is not by accident that all the, if there was ever any intelligent design, this is intelligent design. They have created this encirclement, and Iran is right in the middle of it. Now, Iran is a huge interest to this domination in the region. And Iranian regime is saying, okay, I am prepared to play ball, but you have to give me a bit more. This is, basically it's about dealing and winning, negotiation, negotiating a better bargaining position. So, first of all, there's absolutely nothing new about the nuclear program. Secondly, the fact that Iran wanted to develop nuclear bomb is not a secret either. It obviously wanted to develop. Why not? Why shouldn't it? Who in their right mind wouldn't do that if they could do it in the Middle East? Even the Shah again had the same ideas. There were already a whole nuclear physicist section set up to actually start planning this before the Iranian Revolution. I know for a fact, because I know a few of those people, you know, from university times, they carried on after the revolution, and the new regime backed it up. In fact, I tell you another story. 10, 11 years ago, USA realized they have gone far in actually developing this technology. In order to divert them, they send them a blueprint how to make atomic bomb, but changing few bits and pieces so they come, you know, put them in the wrong track, so they start developing things which are not going to lead anywhere. But the agent who was supposed to carry this apparently told the Iranian, he was a double agent, he told the Iranian, look, this is, you know, this is to trick you. And in fact, it is now alleged, this is CIA report again, that using this blueprint actually helped the Iranians to develop a lot of them, because they used a good part of the plan, you know, to actually do quite a lot more than they could. And they went and bought all the bits and pieces from Pakistan, from Korea, from anywhere they wanted. And, you know, they had this program. They became, and USA knew about it. There's nothing secret about this. They knew about it. Why didn't they say anything before? The reason they have started all this game is because of the conflict in Iraq. Basically, U.S. government realizes, they have, as you can see from the reaction of the U.S. administration itself, they have made a huge mistake. Basically, they have gone, you know, occupied the country. Now there is no get-out clause, basically. As soon as they get out, they know Iran is going to dominate. And of course, you know, Israel being the main tool of USA in the Middle East to prevent, you know, the Arab Revolution, basically, to prevent the Arabs rising up against these corrupt regimes in the Middle East, that's what it plays, that's its role. So you cannot allow, you know, this develop. So they have brought this out, which everybody knows is true. So, despite all the denials, you know, those who know that this is true. So, if you want my honest opinion, but don't quote me on it, I bet you they have already developed one. And the West knows about this. So all these, you know, gimmicks are, you know, around containing this and basically reaching a deal. But of course, you know, I could be wrong. But it's a red herring. Basically, it's related to the quagmire that U.S. imperialism finds itself in Afghanistan and Iraq, both of which are now more or less dominated by Iranian state. In fact, without Iranian help, USA could not stay in Iraq for 1 week. Without Iranian help, Karzai's government in Afghanistan would collapse in 1 week. You know, without military and financial support of the Iranian state, the whole strategy of USA in the Middle East is collapsing. So they're making those deals already there. But don't forget, in the Middle East, you also have Saudi Arabia. You also have Egypt. Those are Israel. They are saying, look, these guys, you know these guys. These guys, if they, you know, because they are the same type of guys. They know each other. If these guys, you know, gain power, they're going to, you know, destroy the whole of, you know, Middle East. They're going to take over Saudi Arabia. They're going to take over Egypt. You know, they know each other. So USA has to play a balancing act, has to play some sort of, you know, look, you know, I'm containing this, but on the other, look, I bring you to the table, let's sit and negotiate, you know, maybe we can collaborate in Afghanistan. And also the Iranian regime has used this pretext of, you know, U.S. threat of war and this nuclear thing to whip up, you know, nationalist sentiments. Iranians, unfortunately, are, you know, given their history, quite nationalism is quite strong. So they're playing the nationalist card, basically. And using this, they're not suppressing every mass movement. All the leading cadres are arrested as being foreign agents, basically. How dare you go on a strike when you're under threat of military attack by USA? You must be in collusion with USA. This is very normal accusation not being used against women, students, workers, no matter for whatever reason they have gone on protest or on a strike. And it cuts ice. Because despite what the West thinks, that the Iranians all love, you know, USA, and they all want to, you know, become, same as USA, there is deep resentment of U.S. imperialism in Iranian psyche because of all this past history. Maybe a obvious section may, be very pro-USA, but the population as a whole, especially the sort of working class and poorer sections of the Iranian population, are by no means lovers of USA. And in fact, this even confuses some of the worker activists themselves. Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know this guy who helped me was, CIA agent. Oh, I'm sorry, I go and denounce it myself. He goes by, they release him to go back to his workers and say, look, we've been fooled, don't do this. This is machinations of US imperialism. Even solidarity movement, now with the working class, is being tainted with this type of, which, as I said, is quite a powerful argument, and it has already destroyed the student movement, the workers' movement, and the women's movement. Because a lot of groups, Iranian political groups, Iranian political opposition abroad, are not careful enough about these things. They don't mind, because now, because Iran is so much in the focus now, Iran is in the news so much. If you remember, even President Bush got up and defended Tehran bus workers. You remember, he made a speech in which he said, I defend Tehran bus workers. When you reach this situation, this certainly opportunist, but a lot of it is because of, they have no choice. They have to sort of clutch at any straws. Anybody who's prepared to sign your petition, anybody who's prepared to help you, you get there. So there's a lot of American Israeli lobbies now financing various Iranian so-called political opposition groups in solidarity with women, the students, workers in Iran, which has actually damaged the new rise in the mass movement beyond, recognition.
Intervene just to give Torb a break for a second. Like, Torb is talking there about the fact that the United States has infiltrated groups like women's rights groups and the student movement and the women's movement and trade unions in Iran. But I think that one of the worst problems is that, for me, is that the left and the workers' movement outside Iran must be the ones to take up those struggles and not leave it to the United States to pose as the defenders of freedom and liberation. Because we've seen what the United States has done in Afghanistan. We've seen the situation, for instance, for women in Afghanistan has become actually far more dangerous in many places than it even was under the Taliban, and I'm not defending the Taliban. They pose as defenders of democracy and women's rights in an effort to win support from people from the West for an invasion or for sanctions and to undermine the real movement from below. Because as Torab said, they don't actually want the real movement coming to power. What they want is to continue to be able to control the government in that region in order to ensure access to the resources of oil or whatever other interests they have. This is my view. So therefore I think that the slogans of Hands Off People of Iran, which is why I think it's an important campaign, is because what we are saying is defend the people of Iran, defend the struggles of the people of Iran, and yes, we have to be careful in terms of what we contact or what we say because of the threat, because of the fact that the state is using the threat of the United States from outside to call everybody who rises up against this an agent. But at the same time, I think we mustn't be guilty of doing the opposite and keeping quiet on these questions. If the workers' movement throughout the world takes up those slogans, actually gives solidarity, then I think that that becomes something real, and that's something very important. So, you know, I just think that that's an important point to make, because I think that, you know, that that's what real solidarity is about.
You want to come in?
No, I have to disagree with you that the women's movement is led by agents of the U.S. in Iran. I mean, the women's movement, as far as I can tell, is
that.
Okay, so maybe I just got it wrong. I just wanted to make sure that's not what I was hearing, because it was repeated a couple times that was. You know, I just see the women's movement in Iran as one of the largest movements against the government, and it's an indigenous movement, and it's not led by the U.S. or U.S. agents at all. And I just wanted to make sure that that wasn't what was being said about the women's movement within Iran. So I'm sorry if I got that wrong.
Yeah.
Thank you, and I'll let Pat in.
No, it's just again to say on it, like, being that definitely I wouldn't think either, like, being that the women's movement are led by the CIA in Iran or led by the CIA or anything like that. It's just some groups have taken money, perhaps from the wrong organisations, and it's happened with left-wing groups, left-wing Iranian groups as well, like, you know, and not always deliberately, not always that they themselves are counter-revolutionaries, but, you know, you just have to be very careful who you actually take money from. The same is true of some of the trade union support as well. Like, we know, you won't condemn it. Like, I mean, if something like, say, the International Transport Federation, like, I mean, supports, say, would support workers on strike, like, I mean, in Iran, but you'd hope as well that they'd actually, like, I mean, also take a line against any invasion of Iran. Now, I believe it's possible with organisations like the International Transport Federation. In the past, the CIA may have had some links into it, but that's not true now, because nowadays, say, the International Transport Federation would actually have very good anti-imperialist positions on both Venezuela and Cuba. So I think you can also adopt an equally good position, actually, on Iran as well. Like, I mean, if it comes under pressure, like, I mean, from constituent organisations, especially maybe from some of the workers from inside Iran itself, it's not like I mean, to think that the majority of people out there who are Iranian dissidents are actually being fooled by the CIA. It's just that some are, and you just have to be a bit careful of who you take money from or take support from.
Just want to come in, but that's exactly the argument that the regime uses to brutalize and to shut down all of activity of women's rights movements within Iran, and they've done it time and time again, arresting Iranian women scholars, putting them in jail. Nobody knows where they are, and they're always accusing them of taking money from the U.S. government. So I don't know if there's a whole lot of you know, factual evidence that shows that these women have received lots of money from the American government in order to fund women's rights movements. I think that's definitely an argument that the regime uses against women's rights movements, and we have to be really careful about that. Not that I totally disagree with you, but that is one, you know, rhetoric of the regime.
So. No, I mean, I wouldn't.
Just a small point, just like coming back on that subject. Sorry, like, if I didn't make it clear enough. But what I've said is that our campaign does support the struggle, must support the struggle, and calls for the support of the struggle of women's rights in Iran. The problem at the moment is that the Iranian regime is using the fact of American pressure on it to crack down on the people inside Iran. Like, even with the sanctions, like, I asked Horab about this earlier, he said the sanctions are having an effect, but actually what the regime is doing is blaming all unemployment on the sanctions. They use every opportunity to blame the United States, and because the United States is so unpopular in Iran, people therefore support the government. And the other point I'd make is that it's very important, and this is why I made the point about Afghanistan, is not to have illusions in the possibility of being, and I'm not saying you do, but that, you know, maybe some groups could have illusions in the Americans making things a bit better, because obviously, as we've seen, they actually make things worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I apologize if I created that impression. I didn't mean that. I meant the fact that suddenly USA and, you know, Western sort of capitalist countries have become interested for the cause of democracy in Iran is actually causing more damage in the Iranian revolution than, you know, if they just remain as silent and compliant with the Iranian mullah's massacre of the Iranian population, which, because they have been silent for 30 years, you know. This regime has, you know, killed in one summer alone 40,000 political prisoners. Nobody lifted a finger. Now suddenly everybody has become interested for the cause of democracy in Iran. Even the fascist, you know, the semi-fascist, you know, Dutch government, you know, which the Dutch left calls fascist in Armani suits, you know, these modern fascists that, you know, are not running around in Europe. Even they have devoted 15 million euros annually for the cause of democracy to various projects. Now, as soon as some of these groups get associated with any of these type of funds, and you have many, Solidarity Center in USA, part of the American Trade Union Confederation, set up to actually, you know, prepare for Velvet Revolution, you know, and even the Transport Federation, say, have you forgotten the role it played in Ukraine only 5 years ago, organizing the strike for the Orange Revolution? So even, you know, Transport, International Transport Federation, a lot of these organizations, after the breakup of the Cold War, have become a bit sort of, they're trying to gain new ground, you know, for even ICFTU, United with CGT. CGT in France joined it. The same International Confederation of Free Trade Unions set up to during the Cold War, now has the, you know, CGT as part of it. So they are not as they were before. I agree, there is contradictory. But nevertheless, you should not forget some of them. For example, the fund by the Dutch government, in Dutch newspapers themselves, they published a paper that these funds were not actually given by the Dutch government. They were American funds being channeled via the Dutch government, because CIA didn't want these funds to go direct. So there's a lot of these things going on. And unfortunately, some of the Iranian opposition groups abroad are becoming the middlemen for, you know, they are the VLS, they are, you know, not out of bad intention a lot of times, out of a stupidity, opportunism, or being so isolated and 30 years in exile, you know, you anything, you know, is a godsend, you know, for, so they jump at it. But I'm saying, this type of approaches by U.S. institutions, international institutions, so-called, you know, for the cause of democracy in Iran, has actually done more damage than help. I'm not saying the leadership of the student movement, the leadership of the women's movement, the leadership of the workers' movement are American agents. A lot of Iranian worker militants, student militants, how do they know? They hear this, you know, project in, you know, Holland is supporting them. So they say, yeah, fine. Well done. Thank you very much. They join in. They go in. They, you know, without even realizing. Then they are confronted by the security. This has happened on a number of occasions. They take these people to jail. They confront all the evidence. They say, look, this money is CIA money. No, this is art. Did you know about it? So, I didn't know about it. Then the guy who was arrested comes out and denounces the others for taking this type of support. This is how they're weakening. This is precisely what they did to the student movement. They took, in one biggest swoop, they arrested 500, 600 student activists, then confronted them with all this evidence, few individuals, then release few of the others to go and spread all these stories out, that this is what has happened. So that's what I'm saying, that so-called, you know, U.S. or Western government solidarity is the cause of democracy. Not only is it falling, but it's actually causing more damage. So that's what I meant. Not that the leadership of these movements, you know, even if one individual may consciously do this, in no shape or form the leadership of any of these movements is not dominated by U.S. imperials. On Kevin, would you still want to answer to your question or not? Or are you going to ask another question?
I was going to say another thing as well. One of the things that strikes me about solidarity in this period is that here in Ireland now there's an historic attack on the working class. So, you know, I've seen people speaking at a meeting on Columbia last night. I didn't go to it for that very reason. The people who are on the platform are supporters of the attempt of the Irish working class. So it's easy to distinguish that solidarity with Colombian workers is fake, phony, you know. And a lot of the trade union bureaucracies with the Western world are sitting on their hands, are supporting the offensive against workers in the West. So their solidarity with Iranian workers or any other workers in the third world is quite clearly phony in the context of a huge global sort of offensive now. But I would like you to say something about the factory occupations, because I think it, I'm not sure how they were defeated, you know, the process of it.
In fact, you probably know this. I mean, the workers' movement within the Iranian Revolution played a very crucial role. In fact, the conditions for the insurrection to succeed was brought about by 4 months of general strike. By, you know, there were almost 4 million workers. So in the last 4 months before the insurrection, we had a general strike in Iran involving almost 4 million workers. During that period, and this is in fact one of the reasons why you can see how it is an anti-capitalist revolution, because exactly the same type of mass organization that develops in anti-capitalist revolutions appears in Iran. You have neighborhood committees and factory committees developing almost everywhere. Basically, most of the neighborhood areas within the sort of working class or poorer sections of the towns were run by the local committees. They were distributing oil, distributing petrol, whatever was, because of the general strike. They took over the whole distribution of the necessities for 4 months, and they were running the place, basically. And these workers' committees, after the insurrection, called themselves councils, shoras in Iran. Of course, being under the influence of the Islamic leadership, a lot of them called themselves even Islamic shoras. But they were by no means nothing to do with the Islamic leadership. They were genuine workers' councils, which developed in the course of the general strike. And after the insurrection, most of the owners of these factories had either escaped already abroad, or they were sort of, you know, thrown out of the factory by the workers. So I don't know if you remember. You remember we had all these arguments in the 60s in European left about workers' control or workers' management. In Iranian situation, the contradiction was resolved. They were both managing and controlling, because there was no manager. They would appoint somebody among themselves as manager, and in fact, some of them even, this is amazing, some of them even started realizing their interest lies different from the merchant class. They were not selling their goods from the factory to the merchants of the bazaar, but setting up tents in Tehran and distributing it directly to the population. A lot of consumer goods were actually distributed in the first 2 months after the insurrection in Tehran by workers' committees themselves, rather than through the middleman or through the merchants of the bazaar. So it was a powerful movement. two, three reasons, you know, led to his gradual defeat. The first was, obviously, leaving aside the actual confusion about the leadership, that was already there. The first was nobody within the Iranian left, except one group, called for unification of the council movement. When the insurrection took place and this provisional government, Bazargan's government, was appointed to succeed the Bakhtiar government, the only voice of protest was from the oil workers who said, "Did you consult us? Why are we not in the Revolutionary Council?" And of oil workers are a powerful section of the Iranian working class, precisely because of their position rather than their numbers. And it's a very old section of the Iranian working class, which goes back to pre-1953 coup. So they have a big tradition also. But other than that, no left group called for unification of the councils. Why? Because the Iranian left is so Stalinist, they think unless you control something, there's no point in mass movement. Because in all these big factories, there were Muslim workers, there were, you know, leftist workers, there were monarchist workers, there were all sorts of different workers. They concentrate on these little, you know, workshops where they could dominate. Basically, most of the left concentrated its effort in small areas or among students or among, you know, other sections of the population rather than these committees. And what happened? The same group of Islamic students who later on took over the U.S. embassy, students following the Imam's line, they used to call themselves, the same students, with the help of the Iranian Public Prosecution Office, the Islamic Public Prosecution Office, they set up this committee, went around factories, appointed people to the management of these factories, wherever there was no management, and united all these under their own umbrella. So basically, the Islamic United, for example, in Tehran, almost out of probably 1,500 or so major, you know, industrial units, almost 700 were brought in under this umbrella organization, managed by basically the Iranian regime. So that was the first reason why it sort of, you know, more or less beheaded the council movement. And the left, instead of participating in this and fighting inside this world, "Oh, these are Islamic, we don't want to have anything to do with it. We go in our little, you know, this little textile factory, these 20 workers that, you know, you dominate one, then the other 19 would follow," type of situation. They basically went for the small fish which they could dominate. For example, Fedayis, Peykar, the various groups in Iran, in Tehran, would organize United Shura Councils of South Tehran. But factories weren't in South Tehran. All the factories were in West Tehran. Why don't you go and organize in West Tehran? Why? What, in South Tehran, you have brick factories, textile factories, none of them more than 20, 30 workers. So that's one reason. Second one, and this is quite important, was the actual U.S. Embassy occupation. Because during the U.S. Embassy, the Iranian regime used the U.S. Embassy occupation to basically totally disrupt the workers' movement. So they would go, for example, you know, at the time, factories were still being controlled, in many cases even managed by the workers' committees, by these, you know, councils. This is 6-7 months into the revolution. Yeah. They would go to these meetings that already appointed their own people in various positions. "Look, why are you sitting here? You know, this is crucial time in the U.S. Embassy. Let's go and support, you know, the students following the Imam's line who have, you know, taken this, you know, great Satan, you know, to basically we had a whole, you know, 6 months of, you know, carnival, you know, basically a charade in front of the U.S. Embassy. All, you know, workers were being, busloads of workers were being brought to clap for the students following the Imam's line. And in the course of that 6 months, as you know, almost every section of the Iranian left became a split anyway, in reaction to whether or not we should support the occupation of U.S. Embassy. All the major Iranian left groups split, and in fact the majority went for the line of supporting the anti-imperialist credentials of the Iranian regime. So that's the second one. The third one was the war. If that didn't kill the workers' movement, a few months later, Iran-Iraq war started, which lasted for 8 years. I have a personal experience of this. When the first Iraqi planes came to bombard Ahvaz in the south of Iran, this is in the oil area, in Ahvaz there was this steel industry. I was actually there in that meeting. We had a meeting, and in fact the left was winning the election in the Shura elections. And as we were actually, you know, putting, you know, votes on the ballot paper, Iraqi planes came over and bombarded the factory. You had 8 years of this. Basically, not only, you know, normal life was disrupted for 8 years, because every night we had all these Iraqi planes bombarding Tehran, bombarding, you know, every night we had, you know, sorties, you know, aerial bombardment. For almost 4 years this went on, you know, and the whole war went for 8 years, but 4 years we had daily, nightly, you know, aerial bombardments. And then this whole, again, you know, mobilizing the workers for the war effort, increased production for the oil effort, became the main slogan of the day. Some of left groups even took that slogan up. Unfortunately, even a section of our own comrades is split with us because of this, and because we weren't supporting the war effort. So this became, and after, you know, when the Iran-Iraq war finished, basically the Islamic shuras were all closed down also, and now called Islamic societies. So instead of Islamic councils, which had elections, which had, you know, meetings, it was sort of factory assembly every time they needed to discuss something, now became an Islamic association, which was more or less run by the local unit of the Revolutionary Guards outside. So I think those three factors, more or less, and then you had a whole period of suppression until 8-9 years ago, when again this mass protest has built up, and we have reached a situation in which you can see new signs of a mass movement, you know, emerging. So for all that period, basically the working class never got up from that defeat after the war, basically.
You'll find other audio downloads at www.wsm.ie.